From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Tanya Mosley. It's Here and Now. Did Michael Bloomberg survive his first presidential candidates debate? He bore the brunt of most of the attacks, and he also pushed back against some of them. Here's Bloomberg sparring with frontrunner Bernie Sanders.
Billionaires today, if you can believe it, have an effective tax rate lower than the middle class.
The tax code. Why are you complaining? What? Who wrote the code?
You and your campaign.
Adisu DeMessi joins us now. He ran Cory Booker's presidential campaign until Booker dropped out last month, and he hasn't put his support behind any campaign just yet. But Adisu, what are your thoughts on how Bloomberg did?
You saw a little bit of rustiness on the stage, without question. I think he's going to get better, and I think it was a tough night for him that portends a pretty tough campaign, but that's the way these things should be.
I want to also ask you something else about Bloomberg. So you've run a grassroots campaign. Your candidate, Cory Booker, had to drop out because he failed to qualify for two debates. But here we have Bloomberg, who spent records amount of his own money on TV ads, and he really only qualified for the debate after the Democratic Party did away with the grassroots donor threshold. Do you think that Bloomberg's presence is helping or hurting the party and narrowing the field?
Well, it certainly isn't helping narrowing the field. I think, you know, to still have, I would say, seven credible candidates out there who can potentially hit 15% and amass a delegate in the state is a lot for this moment. But, you know, I think the reality is we're seeing voters sort of make a different decision now that we've gotten into the election year than they were making last year when they were when polling was essentially driven by name recognition. They have a new choice in Mike Bloomberg that they may not have thought they were going to have at this point last year. But that's what voting is. That's what the elections are. What campaigns are about making choices.
Let's go down the line on some big moments. Elizabeth Warren seemed to have a lot of fiery zingers. She really went in on her rivals on health care, starting with Pete Buttigieg.
It's not a plan, it's a PowerPoint. And Amy's plan is even less. It's like a post-it note. Insert plan here.
Amy Klobuchar came under attack by Pete Buttigieg for failing to identify or be able to name Mexico's president.
You're on the committee that does trade. You're literally in part of the committee that's overseeing these things. And we're not able to speak to literally the first thing about the politics of the country to ourselves.
Are you trying to say that I'm dumb, or are you mocking me here, Pete?
And also, frontrunner Bernie Sanders seemed to be under attack for his Medicare for All health care plan and his position as a Democratic socialist. Do you feel like the candidates missed an opportunity to go after him?
No, I think it's interesting. Right now, there's this competition between a lot of those candidates we just heard to be that anti-Sanders, to be that last person standing, man or woman standing, when this thing narrows down. And so it's a bit of game theory here. If you take down Sanders, is that necessarily going to be to your benefit or to one of your competitors' benefit? It becomes easier maybe to just go after your rivals and see if you can be that number two and leave the fight with Sanders to another day.
Which brings up another big issue, really the big issue. Do you think that this will be a brokered convention with no established candidate going on if that happens?
I think the odds every day get higher and higher. I think the debate made it even greater. And as long as there are a number of credible candidates in the race who can amass a certain number of delegates, it's going to become mathematically next to impossible for somebody to get to 50+1% of the delegates before the convention in July if this number of candidates sustain.
So after Nevada is South Carolina. There's been so much talk about who black voters will most align with ahead of the primary there. The vote, of course, is not a monolithic vote. I spoke with some South Carolina voters last night who say they really aren't as into Joe Biden as they were before Iowa. Is it still Biden's to lose? What are you watching for?
I do think it's still Biden's to lose. I think without question that so-called firewall has eroded a little bit. But I do think that Sanders, Warren, Tom Steyer, who wasn't even on the debate stage last night but has put a lot of resources into South Carolina, are all competing for African-American votes. And frankly, I think that's a good thing. But I'm not sure that, you know, as you said, black voters are not a monolith. And I'm not sure that black voters are going to coalesce around one candidate as they did in 16 around Clinton or 08 around Obama. We could see actually a fracturing of the black vote in South Carolina. And just as importantly, beyond, you're going to know a lot between now and March 17th when there are about three huge Super Tuesdays on the 3rd, 10th, and 17th of March. And when March 18th, the sun comes up, we may be headed towards a long, long slog towards Milwaukee in July.
Adisu Damesi was campaign manager for Cory Booker's presidential campaign, which ended last month. Thank you so much for joining us.
It was a pleasure, Tanya. Anytime.
Well, let's get more on the debate now. And another tense moment from last night when Elizabeth Warren pushed Michael Bloomberg to answer accusations of gender discrimination at his company.
We have a very few non-disclosure agreements.
How many is
that? Let me finish.
How many is that?
None of them accuse me of doing anything other than maybe they didn't like the joke I told. And let me just put, there's agreements between two parties that wanted to keep it quiet. And that's up to them. They signed those agreements, and we'll live with it.
So wait, when you say it is up to, I just want to be clear. Some is how many?
And it went on and on. Here and now is Peter O'Dowd. Watched the debate with a group of Democrats in Las Vegas ahead of the Nevada caucuses on Saturday. He joins us now from Las Vegas. Hi, Peter.
Hey, Jeremy.
So you were watching with Bernie Sanders supporters. He is leading in the polls nationally and there in Nevada. What did they think?
Well, Jeremy, I think it's pretty fair to say that Bernie Sanders supporters are feeling pretty confident going into Saturday. But even though this was a Bernie Sanders campaign event, an official event, people I spoke with, everyone I spoke with, said that that moment that we just heard with Elizabeth Warren really, really, really made the debate. You know, Elizabeth Warren needed to do well. She needed to make a name for herself here in Nevada. And Dana Sherholtz said she did exactly that.
Her intelligence and skill at really putting Mike Bloomberg's record on the line with all of the non-disclosure act stuff, I think was brilliant to do it on live television.
And the big question was, how is Mike Bloomberg going to do in this debate? How do you think he did?
I think it's really apparent in just watching him and listening to him and watching his mannerisms. He's in over his head. He's in deep water.
What else did people say about Bloomberg's performance?
Well, I mean, universally panned. But of course, you have to consider the audience there. This is the anti-billionaire group against the billionaire. People were very upset when he made that comment about his finances being too complicated for TurboTax. One person told me that his mere presence on the stage was a waste of time. They should be talking about Medicare for All, health care, immigration reform, instead of spending time on his, as he called it, a vanity campaign. It's important to remember, Bloomberg is not on the ballot in Nevada. And, you know, even though he's shooting up in national polls, people feel pretty dismissive of his campaign here. In fact, Jeremy, a couple of other billionaires are making bigger waves in Vegas. Donald Trump is here over the next couple of days causing problems with traffic. And Tom Steyer has billboards all over the place. He's trying to make a run in Nevada, although I did meet some Steyer supporters, but I don't know how well he'll do.
How did the crowd respond to criticism of Sanders? He was pressed last night to release his health records after his recent heart attack, and he was also called to answer for the bullying his supporters have been accused of online.
Yeah, you know, boos from the crowd at the mere premise of those questions. You know, Jeremy, I'm standing outside the Culinary Union right now in the shadow of the Stratosphere Hotel. And the backstory is that last week, the Culinary Union came out against Sanders' Medicare for All plan because they want to keep their health care. As a result of that, the union says Sanders' supporters were very, very threatening online and on social media to union members and to the leadership. Of course, that came up last night. Sanders said he wouldn't tolerate any of those attacks. And he even floated the idea that it might be the Russians who are responsible for, you know, trying to stir up problems in this campaign. But, you know, I asked yesterday the culinary leadership and they said, you know, look, we'll show you what we got. This was absolutely Sanders supporters and they totally dismissed that.
You know, the debate last night was much feistier than previous debates. I was thinking to myself, this feels like a totally different presidential race than it did just a couple weeks ago. Could people there in Nevada sense a shift in urgency heading into the caucuses this Saturday?
No doubt. I mean, as I said, boos, cheers, raucous yelling and screaming at the TV, I think just like the candidates at the Paris Hotel. People here in Nevada are feeling fired up. Here's Via Reynolds talking about that moment with Buttigieg and Klobuchar.
I feel like everyone is, you know, trying to fight for their place in as the primary candidate. And with Amy Klobuchar, I mean, she was being attacked unnecessarily. And we haven't really seen, like, that much feistiness out of Amy Klobuchar. So for me, I just I thought that was something new, and like, I'm glad that she put him in his place. I was like, yes, girl, do it. And I think it made it more entertaining.
So it made it more entertaining, but the question is whether or not that's going to translate into people caucusing on Saturday. I think the early results, the early voting, the early caucusing so far shows that it likely will. The numbers, about 75,000 people came out to vote over the last couple of days. That's almost what they saw here in Nevada in all of 2016.
Interesting.
So I think that people in Nevada are eager to get their chance to, you know, say how they feel about this race and whether or not they can shift the narrative. That's still to be determined.
That is Here and Now's Peter O'Dowd reporting from Las Vegas, and we're going to hear more from Peter tomorrow. Peter, thanks.
You're welcome.
And here are the latest numbers from the World Health Organization on the new coronavirus. COVID-19 has spread to more than 75,000 people around the world, mostly in China, and more than 2,100 people have died. That includes two Japanese passengers from the Diamond Princess cruise ship, which has been docked in Yokohama. Hundreds of people have left the ship so far, with the quarantine now officially over, but many are still on board. Several hundred Americans from the ship are now in quarantine in the U.S., including Rachel and Tyler Torres. They were on their honeymoon when they were quarantined for almost 2 weeks on board the Diamond Princess before being evacuated Sunday to Lackland Air Force Base in Texas. And that's where they join us from. Rachel and Tyler, thanks for joining us.
Yeah, sure thing.
So you were on that evacuation flight to the United States that it turned out had 14 infected people on it. Are you worried at this point that you may have contracted COVID-19 on that plane?
So we're not all that worried just because we wore masks for the whole time. The only concern that we had is just because it was a 12-hour flight. There was water and food that was supplied to us. And so there was those brief periods where we took off our masks.
They are going to be testing us through the CDC too. So.
And when was the last time you were tested?
We were on that first 273 on the boat that got tested, and we came back negative.
Mm-hmm. Were you worried when you were on the boat that you were, even if you were quarantined in your cabin, that you would be exposed through the air somehow?
Not so much on the boat. We felt relatively safe just because we took extra precautions. We made sure to wash our hands after touching everything and anything. Anytime we had our outside time, we just stuck our hands in our pockets and stayed away from people.
What was that like to be quarantined on that ship for so long?
It was kind of interesting. It was a little bit of an emotional roller coaster. We kind of went through some ups and downs, but we made friends with the people kind of across the hallway from us and then next door to us. So we were able to kind of meet a lot of new people that we wouldn't have necessarily before, especially via social media and emails.
You were just meeting them digitally?
Yes. And then just through brief periods when we would open our doors to the hallway during mealtimes. So we were able to kind of see people and kind of talk to them. Our friends are now from the UK, and then there's some other people from California who were both across the hallway.
So Australia.
We would email them pictures of what it was like outside because we had a balcony, which really helped us a lot on the boat, and they were in interior staterooms, so we would send them pictures.
Well, and how does that work to have mealtime on that boat? Do you stay away from people? Do you have the mask on the whole time?
So the way that they did it, everybody was confined to their rooms. They had the kitchen still cooked as usual, and then all of a sudden they had room service three times a day to like 1,200 rooms. Wow. So that was a little bit of a logistical nightmare, but they really nailed it down after a couple of days.
Now, they offered you a choice. You could either finish the quarantine on the ship or come back and do a 2-week quarantine in the U.S. Why did you decide to come back?
Yeah, that was a little bit of a tough choice for us. When we first got the email from the embassy, in a nutshell, it said, hey, we're bringing two flights over here. We're going to test you before you get on the flight, but you won't get your results until you land. And by the way, if you don't come, you won't be able to come back into the United States for, quote unquote, a period of time. So that was enough for us to just say, you know, maybe we should just cut our losses because there's more cases on this boat. We're probably going to get exposed in the plane. Let's just get it over with. If we're going to get sick, go to the hospital, get it done with, go home.
And do you think you made the right choice?
Yeah, absolutely. I think we did. Now the CDC and the military and the DMAT have been doing really a wonderful job of keeping us safe and healthy. quarantine here is a little bit stricter than it was on the cruise ship. So we're really hopeful that this time the quarantine will work and that people will stay healthy over here.
And what's the quarantine like there at the base? I assume you're not getting room service multiple times a day, or are you?
The fun thing is, yeah, we actually are.
Okay.
So the people who are in disaster management teams, they're coming around a couple times a day. Sometimes they bring sodas, waters, and it's nice because on the ship, you know, we can have one or two of everything, but here, if you ask for more water, they'll give you a whole pack if you want it. They just have an endless supply, it seems like. And I think they contracted out with some company to bring us foods because it's been really good. They've got laundry service that, oops, I completely forgot about today. There's trash that we can put out. And every time somebody comes to the door, they're in full hazmat suits. We just wear our mask and stay inside our room. They're working on a way to get us outside, though.
Do you think that when you return home, finally, that people are going to be scared to come into contact with you for a period of time?
I think that kind of hit me today, just that there might be a stigma around us having been on that boat. And I know a lot of people may have some fear about the coronavirus just because there's not a lot of information out there right now. Obviously, the CDC wouldn't release us from this base if they didn't believe that we were safe to walk around in public. They don't want us spreading this any more than we want to spread this to people. So I'm a little concerned, but we're hoping that through these interviews, we'll give kind of a personal face to the people who have been on the boat, and we're hoping to kind of reduce that stigma.
What about your employment situation? Are you going to be okay having been off of work for so long?
Yeah, so I just graduated from a master's program for occupational therapy. So I was actually supposed to start my first career job on Monday. So they have agreed to delay my start date, which has been awesome. And I'm just excited to go back and start.
And then for me, I work at a big hospital in Dallas. So
they get it. It's healthcare.
Yeah. Yes. Yeah, I'm a nurse. And it's one, it's easy for me to get off in the first place. And then two, I just emailed my boss, said, hey, so I'm kind of stuck for 2 weeks. She said, okay, all right, keep me updated. And then 2 weeks later, hey, I'm going to be another 2 weeks. They've been really understanding with it. And it's kind of nice to be able to have that kind of support.
So how much of this experience are you on the hook for? Or do you have any idea if you're going to have to pay for any of it?
Actually, you know, we joke, you know, awful honeymoon and whatnot, but it's actually kind of nice because Princess refunded us 100% and gave us another free cruise up to the value that we paid. So we got a free honeymoon out of it.
Which has helped a lot with like the lost wages since we've been in quarantine.
Yeah, we had a month of quarantine, so that one's not that fun, but it could always be worse. We're keeping our heads up about it.
So do you think that you're going to go on another cruise after this?
Absolutely, especially if it's free.
Yeah.
A long time from now.
Maybe a few road trips first.
That is Rachel and Tyler Torres, who are quarantined right now at Lackland Air Force Base in Texas. They were quarantined before that on the Diamond Princess cruise ship that remains docked off of Japan. Thank you so much for joining us, and good luck. I hope you can get back to normal life soon.
Yeah, thanks so much.
Thank you so much.
We've been talking for a few weeks now about the impact of the COVID-19 virus on China's economy. And now we're starting to see how the industries are most affected. One of those is the global garlic industry. Prices for garlic have seen a sharp increase over the last several months. And Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent, joins us now with more. And Ali, here's a fact that many of us might not have known. More than two-thirds of fresh garlic that the U.S. imports actually comes from China. What has been the impact on garlic shipments?
Yeah, I definitely didn't know that, and I consume a great deal of garlic. And actually, Americans are consuming much more garlic than they used to. So we've got two types of garlic costs. We've got the wholesale and the retail garlic. So let's take retail, the one that you buy at the store. The cost of five bulbs, a sleeve of garlic, was about $1.43 in stores during the first couple of weeks of February compared to January. That's an increase. That is a major increase, but it's not as big as the 60% increase in wholesale garlic because we import so much garlic. China produced about 49 billion pounds of garlic in 2018.
Wow, it's hard to wrap my head around that.
Well, I don't even know what that looks like in numbers. But the U.S. imported 199 million fresh pounds of garlic in 2018, most of which came from China, the 70% of which came from China. So if you like garlic, the price of garlic has gone up.
I know it's hard to tell, I'm guessing, but is this a short-term impact, or will we see prices gradually go up, up, and up over time?
Well, we have to think about it more broadly as other commodities, right? There are other things that have gone up and gone down. If you look at soybeans, for instance, China is a major importer of soybeans, and those prices have gone down because Chinese demand has gone down. So the thing we have to think about is how long this whole thing lasts. China's production of kind of everything it does has slowed down since the outbreak of COVID-19 or coronavirus. Garlic takes about 9 months to grow, and then it gets harvested in the summer. But everything about, you know, garlic is a good way to understand the whole production supply chain in China, right? There are farms on which people are not working. There are roads and shipping routes that have been closed down. There are factories that are closed down. So that's it's all part of it. Ultimately, we may be peaking in coronavirus, and people, you know, we have some reports from Procter & Gamble and other companies that factories are opening up again. So it's probably not a long-term thing, but it's a good, very direct indication of how closely tied this global supply chain is.
Yeah, I mean, we're reading 39% of the world's fruit and vegetable production actually comes from that area. We're also reading that Tyson Foods is facing challenges in China. And Tyson Foods CEO Noel White says it's because of COVID-19. What are you hearing?
So the grain of salt here is that a lot of companies are coming out and saying things are not going to be as great, and they're blaming it on COVID-19. And we don't know how to parse that just yet. In some cases, it could be true. Noel White spoke at an investor conference in Florida, and he said there's issues getting chicken exports out of the U.S. and to China. And Tyson's got its own businesses in China, and they're having trouble. He thinks that once the outbreak is contained, things will happen a little more clearly. However, the pork imports from China, imports to China from the United States have increased. China's had this problem, African swine fever. It's a contagious disease, and it affects pigs and things like that. So they're importing more pork, but less chicken at the moment.
Ali Velshi, MSNBC anchor and economics correspondent, thank you.
My pleasure.
We're going to take a few minutes now to listen to some of the tense exchanges in last night's Democratic debate, and there were many to choose from. Here is billionaire Michael Bloomberg and frontrunner Bernie Sanders, the Democratic Socialist.
We have a grotesque and immoral distribution of wealth and income. Mike Bloomberg owns more wealth than the bottom 125 million Americans. That's wrong. That's immoral. That should not be the case when we got 500,000 people sleeping out on the street, when we have kids who cannot afford to go to college, when we have 45 million people dealing with student debt. We have enormous problems facing this country, and we cannot continue seeing a situation where in the last 3 years, billionaires in this country saw an $850 billion increase in their wealth. Congratulations, Mr. Bloomberg. But the average American last year saw less than a 1% increase in his or her income. That's wrong.
Mayor Bloomberg, should you exist?
I can't speak for all billionaires. All I know is I've been very lucky, made a lot of money, and I'm giving it all away to make this country better. And a good chunk of it goes to the Democratic Party as well.
Is it too much? Have you earned too much money? Has it been an obscene amount of money? Should you have earned that much money?
Yes. I worked very hard for it, and I'm giving it away. Right.
Bloomberg was asked about one of Sanders' proposals to give employees up to 20% ownership of large corporations.
I can't think of a ways that would make it easier for Donald Trump to get reelected than listening to this conversation. This is ridiculous. We're not going to throw out capitalism. We tried that. Other countries tried that. It was called communism, and it just didn't work.
Sanders was asked whether a socialist candidate could get elected president.
Let's talk about democratic socialism, not communism, Mr. Bloomberg. That's a cheap shot. Let's talk about democratic. Let's talk about what goes on in countries like Denmark, where Pete correctly pointed out they have a much higher quality of life in many respects than we do. What are we talking about? We are living in many ways in a socialist society right now. Problem is, as Dr. Martin Luther King reminded us, we have socialism for the very rich, rugged individualism for the poor.
Wait a second.
When Donald, let me finish. When Donald Trump gets $800 million in tax breaks and subsidies to build luxury condominiums, that's socialism for the rich. We have to subsidize Walmart's workers who are on Medicaid and food stamps because the wealthiest family in America pays starvation wages. That's socialism for the rich. I believe in democratic socialism working people, not billionaires. Health care for all. Educational opportunity for all.
Senator, thank you. Mayor Bloomberg, would you like to... The question was about socialism.
What a wonderful country we have. The best-known socialist in the country happens to be a millionaire with three houses. What did I miss here?
Well, you'll miss that I work in Washington, House 1.
That's the first problem.
Live in Burlington, House 2.
That's good.
And like thousands of other Vermonters, I do have a summer camp. Forgive me for that. But where is your home? Which tax haven do you have your home?
New York City, thank you very much. Yeah, well, and I pay all my taxes. And I'm happy to do it because I get something for it.
Some of the exchanges from last night's Democratic presidential debate in Las Vegas. Okay, well, let's go on a little vacation now to Hawaii for a special Hawaiian music edition of the Here and Now DJ Sessions. Paige Okamura, a.k.a. DJ Mermaid, is a DJ at Hawaii Public Radio, and she is with us now. Paige, aloha. Welcome to Here and Now.
Aloha. Mahalo for having me.
Well, and where are you right now as we speak?
Right now, I'm in the Hawaii Public Radio studios in Honolulu on the island of Oahu.
And dare I ask what the weather's like right now?
For Hawaii standards, it's cold and windy and rainy.
And by cold, you mean what, 65, 70 degrees?
Maybe not even. Maybe closer to 70.
Okay. All right. We'll just leave it at that and don't give us any more details. Tell me about your show a little bit.
So I'm one of the late night hosts here at Hawaii Public Radio. I have the Tuesday night called Bridging the Gap, and it's a AAA. And every week there is a different theme. But I, outside of my role here at the radio station, I am a Hawaiian language scholar. Mm-hmm. So I specialize in Hawaiian music and Hawaiian language.
Well, and in fact, you are what you call keiki papa of a particular area of Oahu. What does that mean exactly?
So keiki papa basically translates to someone who has been living somewhere for more than five generations.
Well, and you have brought us some Hawaiian music today, so let's get to some of that. The first one is actually a chant, Aua Ia, by Maiki Ayu Lake. So she sounds like she's telling a story about something. What is she saying there?
So this mele, this song, this chant is a prophecy chant. It's several hundred years old now. It was written for Aikanaka, which is one of our chiefs. But it's a prophecy that tells another chief, Kamalala Valu, to hold on to what you have, lest it be stripped away from you.
And why did you want to start off with this one?
So I wanted to start off with this because it tells a lot of where we are today, our social issues, our political issues, especially for Hawaiians. And it is a chant and a hula or a dance that used to live very almost secluded within halau or our hula schools. But it's become almost not quite an anthem, but it has reached beyond its confines that it used to live in, and now thousands of people know this song and this dance, and it has become this model for Hawaiians today to hold on to what we have and to not let it be stripped away from us.
Mm-hmm. Okay, let's get to the next one that you brought us. This is Hano Hano Hale Iwa by the Aloha Pumehana Serenaders. Hano Hano Hale Iwa, kukira kila, kahukele eku, ikali iwa.
See, now, even though it's not 70 degrees, I feel like I'm right there with you, Paige. Tell me about
glad.
This one.
So, Hano Hano Hale Iwa, it's about the place where I'm from. And I'm from Hale Iwa, and in Hawaii, and in Hawaiian music, and Hawaiian thinking, we have this fierce love of land and place. It's called Aloha Aina, but we are proud of where we're from. So many of our songs extol the beauty of where we're from, but it's also like a time capsule. So if you speak the language or you understand or you dance hula, you'd know, you'd get this whole history in about 5 song verses of Hale Iwa.
Okay, well, the next one that you've brought us is called Pua Lili Ehua by the Kaha Uanu Lake Trio. Just beautiful. Tell us about this one.
So this is Pua Lili Lehua by the Kaha Uanu Lake Trio. It's a love song. In Hawaiians, we write beautiful love songs. Mm-hmm. We write beautiful love songs and songs about lovemaking. And that song also comes from my hula lineage, my mother's hula lineage. It was written for her kumuhula. But also, the second verse is my favorite. It talks about, it says, Yaoi e imi ana ina nani o ka aina, e anola au ma'ane'i e kaliana I ko ho'i mai, which basically, roughly translates to, while you're out there searching for the beauties out in the world, I'll be here waiting for you to come back to me.
Mm. It's more beautiful in Hawaiian, I think.
Way more beautiful.
Yeah, right. The next one that you've brought us is Pua Malihini. This is performed by the Kamehameha School. So pua in the title there means flower, right?
Yes. Pua means flower, and malihini actually means foreigner or visitor. It was written by Helen DeShay Beamer for one of her relatives. But in Hawaiian, we have this thing, it's called kauna, which is basically like layers of meaning or innuendo or metaphor. And so when we write songs about people we love or people we don't like, it's often veiled in layers of kauna or metaphor. And so the person that was written for is compared to this pua malihini. But also the significance for that song is that the Kamehameha Schools Concert Glee Club performed it. And Kamehameha Schools is a school for Hawaiian children. So all the classes compete against each other. It's a big deal here. It takes up like 6 hours of TV broadcast time.
Wow.
Everyone watches it. Whether you went to school or not, everybody huddles around their TV and watch a song contest. And this year, all the kids have written and composed their own songs in Hawaiian that reflect social issues today.
And is the Hawaiian language taught to all the students in Hawaii?
It's not. Hawaiian language was actually considered an endangered language by the 70s for a lot of reasons, and we have a long history of colonization and occupation. But after the illegal overthrow of our monarchy, Hawaiian language was essentially socially outlawed. Students in school were punished, corporal punishment, and hit and disciplined for speaking Hawaiian in classrooms. So within a very short span of maybe two generations, we had almost completely lost the language. So even though we have a big language gap for a while, for X number of generations, new work is being produced even today.
Well, it has been a pleasure listening to these songs and hearing about them from you. That is Paige Okamura, who is DJ Mermaid at Hawaii Public Radio in Oahu. Thank you so much. Aloha and mahalo.
Mahalo. Ahuiho.
And if you want to hear more, you can go to our Spotify playlist. That is NPR Here and Now. We're also on Apple Music and at hereandnow.org.
A federal judge has sentenced Roger Stone to 40 months. That's 3 years and 4 months in prison. The political operative and longtime Trump ally was convicted in November of lying to Congress, obstruction and witness tampering as part of the Mueller investigation. In the days leading up to his sentencing, the length of that sentence became the center of a back and forth between the Justice Department and the president. NPR Justice correspondent Ryan Lucas was at the courthouse, and he joins us now with the latest. And Ryan, this has certainly been a high-profile case. Describe the scene in the courtroom today.
Well, the scene at the courthouse was kind of chaotic, as it often is when Roger Stone is on site. Certainly in the morning when I arrived at the courthouse, there were people unfurling a giant black and white banner that showed Roger Stone with his arms extended, his flashing the V for victory sign, and a hashtag, pardon Roger Stone. There was another kind of traveling billboard going by that read, Bill Barr, have you forgotten your oath? It's like all of the issues going on with the justice system and the Justice Department right now kind of descending on the courthouse here in D.C. There were certainly supporters of Stone who turned out today as they did over the course of the trial. And of course, everybody wanted to know leading up to this, what was the sentence for him going to be?
Yeah, and prosecutors had originally recommended 7 to 9 years for Stone. It was at that point that President Trump and Attorney General William Barr stepped in. Remind us how all of that unfolded.
Well, it started last Monday, so more than a week and a half ago, when the four prosecutors who put Stone on trial, who actually prosecuted the case, recommended 7 to 9 years for Stone in their sentencing recommendation. Shortly after that, the president tweeted that he felt that that was unfair. A few hours after that, Attorney General William Barr stepped in and the Justice Department actually reversed course, filed a supplemental sentencing memo saying that the 7 to 9 years was too much. They felt that Stone should face some prison time, but that it should be less than that based on how the attorney's office was actually going to calculate the sentencing guidelines. They deferred to the judge ultimately what that sentence should be. But all of this came up today in court during the hearing. The judge, Judge Amy Berman Jackson, asked the prosecutors in the case what was the cause of all the confusion. And one of the federal prosecutors who was in the courtroom apologized to the judge, said full out, it was not the fault of the four prosecutors who originally handled this case. They had authorization to submit the sentencing memo that they did. But the judge clearly was annoyed by the fact that the government had done this sort of flip-flop on its recommendation for Stone's sentence.
And was that part of her lengthy speech today? People talked about how she spoke at length with federal prosecutors.
This whole hearing actually lasted about 2.5 hours. The back and forth with the government attorneys was not part of that, but what she did was kind of go through point by point how she was going to come to the sentence that she ultimately did, went through all of the sentencing guidelines, which has been part of the cause for the controversy over the recommendation that the government made. Ultimately, though, she took a break, came back, and that is when she gave this very lengthy speech about Roger Stone and the crimes that he was convicted of. And she made clear that this was not a joke. What he did was serious. He was convicted of witness tampering, obstruction, and lying to Congress, basically impeding the House Intelligence Committee's investigation into Russian interference in the 2016 election. And she made clear that this is serious business. She said that what Stone did was a threat to the country's institutions, to the foundations of American democracy. She said his actions can't go unpunished. If they do go unpunished, she said everyone's loses. And she said that what he did really should kind of dredge up dismay and disgust among all Americans, and it should transcend party lines. She made clear that this is something that the American people care about, that Congress cares about, that the Justice Department cares about, and she said it's something that she, Judge Amy Berman Jackson, cares about as well.
And we want to note that Stone was given a chance to address the court before his sentencing, but declined to do so. What happens next? Can we expect an appeal?
Well, part of the reason that Stone likely did not address the court today is because he likely will appeal this decision. Now, there's still one motion that is pending in this case. Stone has filed a motion for a new trial. Judge Jackson said that she would rule on that actually after sentencing. She said that she will deal with that matter in the days and weeks to come. But yes, we do expect Stone to ultimately file an appeal in this case. And then, of course, hanging over all of this is the question of a potential presidential pardon.
Right.
There's been a lot of speculation over the past, well, basically since Stone was indicted in January of 2019, of whether the president would weigh in and ultimately grant Stone a pardon. That has been front and center over the discussions over the past week and a half since this case kind of burst back into the headlines. The president has been asked repeatedly about it in the past few days, and what he consistently says is it's not time to talk about that yet, but he doesn't rule out the possibility of a pardon either.
That's NPR Justice correspondent Ryan Lucas. Ryan, thank you.
Thank you.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Tanya Mosley.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.